is Daryl and Jeff. We like movies and music. Some people would even call us buffs, but we wouldn't go that far. First we'll talk about a movie, and later on we'll talk about a record. Sometimes we fight, but usually we don't fight too bad. And mostly we stay friends.
Getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day it's getting faster. Everyone said go ahead and ask her. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day seems a little longer.
Hey everybody, you're listening to 10 Things I Hate About You 2. My name's Daryl Smith.
Hey, I'm Jeff.
That's like your Pacino, Jeff.
Hey, I'm Jeff.
So we're doing Stand By Me, and we are doing Weezer's The Blue Album, because it's a good album and they have a new album, so I figure...
We're doing Weezer's The Blue Album?
did the Beatles' Blue Album?
I did 311's Blue Album.
So that song we just heard was Every Day. It's featured in the movie, but I want to ask you quickly.
I thought you were going to go Lollipop.
Told you'd be a surprise.
Boom, boom, boom.
How much does that song sound like Silence Kid by Silence Kit, Silence Kid? It's the same melody. Silence Kit. Kid. Da, 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 everyone said go out.
Oh, yeah.
Same.
Except weirder.
Yeah, obviously. But I think that they should give a little bit of credit to Buddy Holly, because they ripped him off just a bit. Let's talk about the movie.
Sure.
Plot synopsis, quickly. Four young boys, played by Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Jerry O'Connell, and Corey Feldman. And I'll give you... We'll start referring to them as their character names in a bit, but they go on an adventure to find a dead body. They all have various troubles at home with their parents, and... Will Wheaton's character, Gordy LaChance, his older brother, played by John Cusack in flashbacks.
Does that kid have troubles at home?
His brother is, like, part of the gang, and I think he sort of comes from... He's, like, the least... They explore his home the least.
What's Fat Kid's name?
Vern. Fat Kid. Apparently that line when he just goes, "Yeah, spit water at the Fat Kid," was just an improv line. Like, he just came up with that out of nowhere.
The brilliance of Jerry O'Connell.
I'll tell you a little bit about that a little bit later, but...
His secret identity was that he was a good actor and never showed off.
So they go on an adventure, is maybe the wrong word, and it becomes less and less of a fun adventure and more serious and somber as they approach the dead body, and they find the dead body, have a showdown with Ace and his gang. Ace is played by Kiefer Sutherland, and he's sort of the bad guy in the movie.
And the best part of the movie, best acting job in the movie.
I think for the age of all those kids, they all put in respectable performances. You disagree. You're shrugging.
I don't know. I've seen better child acting.
Fair. But have you ever seen four kids all in, like, relatively lead roles hold something together?
Sandlot. Just any baseball movie.
Any baseball. What's that movie?
Bad News Bears?
No, pitching movie? Rookie of the Year?
Yeah, there's only one kid in that.
Yeah.
Then there's just Daniel Stern.
Who else is it? Isn't... No, McConaughey's not in Rookie of the Year, is he?
McConaughey's in Angels in the Outfield.
Angels in the Outfield. So many kid baseball movies. Let's talk about Stand By Me. I've seen this movie too many times. This was your first time ever. I've seen it a lot. But certain things only occurred to me for the first time in this movie, which we can get into. But you've seen it for the first time this time.
It's another one of those situations where I pretty much have already seen this movie throughout the years. Like,
sure.
I've seen the leeches scene. I've seen the pie-eating contest scene. The running from the train on the bridge scene. I've seen those
scenes. You've seen the scenes?
Yeah.
Well, what did you think watching it all put together?
A pretty good movie.
Yeah. What was your biggest beef? Because you sort of shrugged.
No beef, really. Like, it's just sort of, it's like a good family movie. Would you call, that a family movie?
Well, this
movie
is what I want to get into, maybe, and like, now that you've brought this up, can we sidetrack? Who is this movie aimed at? Because it's rated R. It's got a
Is it rated R?
Yeah, it's rated R. Yeah, I checked it. And it's got, like, when you watch it with that sort of frame of mind, you realize how much swearing is in it. There's a lot of sort of adult content. It's all about them finding a dead body, which is like, you know, it's definitely not aimed at 11-year-olds or 10-year-olds.
It's aimed at old man hippies.
Is it aimed at old man hippies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just old, like, they're basically, it's aimed at Richard Dreyfuss.
Keep going about how you feel about it.
I think it's a good family movie because, well, it's not a family movie, but we've watched it when we were boys. Like, yeah. It's a movie that you watch when you're boys, even though they're swearing. And
yeah, I definitely watched it when I was like 10 years old or younger.
Yeah. Because it's on television. They probably just believe it with the swears. Right?
Yeah.
But also, you know, like, I wouldn't like buy the DVD.
I don't know what it is. This movie like affects me in a way that I can't articulate, and that like I think it's really great. I don't know why. I cried twice. I tried to hide it from you when we were watching the movie, but the two parts when
I took vines of you crying.
You took vines. Post them. The part when when River Phoenix character is like talking to LaChance and about his parents and like, you're going to be a great writer someday, Gordy. And if your parents are too dumb to see it, then maybe he says something like, I wish to hell I was your parents. And like basically being like, I would like encourage you and push you towards these things. I think that's almost the most unbelievable part of the whole movie to me, is that this 12-year-old kid is like certain and determined to be a writer, that he's like so literary and has been writing stories for like a while prior to this. And that like,
did we finish the plot synopsis?
I think so. They find the body. They have a showdown with Ace and the gang.
Okay.
They float the body back downriver.
The end. The last scene with Dreyfuss typing on his very modern computer. The last like couple sentences seemed kind of bad.
Like bad writing.
Like, how is he a rich writer?
Yeah. I don't know. It's based on a Stephen King.
Well, I suppose it would be the script of the movie. And the movie made lots of money. So yeah, never mind.
I'm gonna play a clip in a minute. I want to play the like final showdown scene, but I felt like there was something. I have so much to say about this movie that it's hard for me to find the spots to start. Who was your favorite of the kid actors?
Pie Puke Man
of the main four.
I have a soft spot for River Phoenix.
I think he's really good, man. Like, aside from the crying scene when he's talking about like the milk money and stuff, which we can play that scene.
It's weird, though, that I was overly critical of River Phoenix, though.
Were you? In this, because you like him so much, you thought he was
because,
like...
Well, I hadn't really seen this movie, or at least not front to back, or in a critical way. And I hold My Own Private Idaho up to such...
High standards.
High standards. It's one of my faves, and he's really great in it. And also, he just has like that sort of Die Too Young mystique about him that I just always buy into, and I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
How strange do you think about the prophetic nature of this movie? That, like, essentially River Phoenix's character dies and Corey Feldman's character goes crazy, which Corey Feldman kind of does.
Right. That's weird.
It's a little, they talk a lot about, like, I was watching this sort of like 25th reunion when, like, all the actors sat down with Rob Reiner and they're talking about how, like, that one shot where he walks away and then fades away kind of thing, and how right. It's pretty, like, strange and, like, kind of ghostly and a little bit prophetic.
It makes sense. I mean, it's hard to say, but when you look at each character of those four boys, it makes, like, River Phoenix, the actor, not the character, exudes a sort of, like, coolness.
Can I tell you something in a second? Well, do you want to finish? Yeah.
Well, just, like, each of the characters and their traits sort of foreshadow their subsequent careers.
Yeah.
So... I don't think Corey Feldman's very good in the movie. He's a boy.
Yeah.
But also, like, you can just, like, tell that he's just not going to really be anything cool. Like, he's not cool in the movie, even though I think they're trying to make him, like, the cool wild poor kid.
I don't think they were trying to make him cool.
Well, no, I guess not. But
I do think
he's not the dweeb like Vern is, you know what I mean?
No. Yeah, Duchamp is like, or not Duchamp, but, yeah, Teddy Duchamp. I don't know how you're meant to interpret him, but they talked about Will Wheaton in that same thing I was watching, talks about how the strength of the, like, actors in this movie has to do with, like, Rob Reiner's casting, and that all of them were sort of like had the like personal attributes of the characters. Like Corey Feldman did come from like a troubled childhood and was like really messed up, and so like I know you didn't think he was very good, but like that was like a realer role for him to play, and that River Phoenix was kind of like a leader and a cooler kid, and like Will Wheaton was shy and sort of turned around. They talk a lot about how like Jerry O'Connell was really funny and had like good comic timing, and he is kind of the funny one in the movie.
Yeah.
Like with the comb and when he like tries to get his comb and all the dumb stuff and spit on the fat kid and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He wasn't a
comedy, but like 10 years later.
What comedy?
It's called Joe's Apartment.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember this movie?
I remember the existence
of that
movie.
It was like an MTV movie.
Is it
there's just like bugs all over his apartment or something weird.
Yeah, I remember that movie. Can I ask you one question? I find a lot of times in movies like this, when you have like four different kids and they're meant to be sort of like archetypes, that the characters feel really shallow, but that these characters feel to me a lot realer and a lot deeper, even though it's still like a little bit cheesy. Like all their backstories are really believable, and I feel like the characters manifest those backstories in their behaviors and actions and stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the strongest parts.
It's one of the strongest parts of the movie. That's why it's a good movie. Because when those things don't really add up and they just are purely archetypes or shallow characters, and they just... It almost sometimes feels like if you're not bothering to flesh out characters, why would you even like bother to make a movie like
this? Another good character too, and we'll play this scene right now,
but those movies get made
all the time,
and I don't even know why,
because like. to make you depressed and angry. Kiefer Sutherland as the embodiment of just like pure evil, like gang leader dude, he's bad in this movie, and in a way that's really believable and just really sinister.
Going quietly cold and sinister is always the best way of playing a bad guy. Going over the top.
Yeah. The part, like, so let's talk about sinister things he does. The part where he just has a death wish in the, like, race down the highway, and he plays chicken, essentially, against that truck and almost gets everybody killed but doesn't care.
Right.
And I think this is one of my favorite lines that I only paid attention to for the first time in this go-around, when he's like, if either of you idiots had $1,000, I'd kill you both.
Right.
And it's just dead serious. Like, he would kill them and take their money and not think twice about it.
Yeah, he's a sociopath.
So let's play the last scene when the four main kids find the body first, and then Ace and his gang show up and they want to try to take the body from them. I should give a warning. There's lots of swearing. There's lots of sort of 1986 movie language.
I'm glad that you're like playing the swears now.
Well, I just think this scene is so good too. There's a lot of 1986 movie language that wouldn't fly today, but flies then. So just
fly. No,
flies the wrong word. You know what I mean?
Leap over a tall building.
Yeah. So it's one of my favorite scenes. It's when they have a confrontation over the dead body right near the end of the movie.
You guys have two choices. You either leave quietly, we take the body, or you stay, we beat the shit out of you, we take the body.
Besides, me and Billy found him first.
Yeah, Vern told us how you found him.
Oh, Billy, I wish we never boosted that car. Oh, Billy, I think I just turned my Fruit of the Looms into a fudge factory.
That's it. Your ass is grass.
Hold it. Okay, Chambers, you little faggot. This is your last chance. What do you say, kid?
Why don't you go home and fuck your mother some more?
You're dead.
Come on, Chris, it's split.
They're not taking
him. Come on, man, this is crazy.
They're not taking him.
He's got a knife, man.
Jeez, come on, man.
You're gonna have to kill me, Ace.
No problem.
You're not taking him. Nobody's taking him.
Come on, kid. Just give me the gun before you take your foot off. You ain't got the sack to shoot a woodchuck.
on this. I'll kill you, I swear to God.
Come on, LaChance, give me the gun. You must have at least some of your brother's good sense.
Suck my fat one, you cheap dime store hood.
What are you gonna do, shoot us all?
No ways. Just you.
How good is that part?
Pretty good.
The no ace, just you, like that sort of like simple and cold like revocation of
they
what he
says.
They
all just started talking like that.
Yeah.
You notice the River started talking very quietly and seriously, and Will Wheaton started talking very quietly and seriously.
That part, that no ace, just you line pumps me up so much. Mm. Can we talk about the one thing I sort of pieced together for the first time in this movie? And I think like what the whole movie's about, which is something that I didn't really get till just now. I mean, there's other pieces, obviously. It's about a lot of different things, but this is one of the main things going on, is that at the very opening scene, he says it was like the summer of 1959 was like the first time I ever saw a dead body. Mm-hmm. But his brother had died like 3 or 4 months prior, and he talks about how his brother has died, but his parents never put the pieces together. So presumably in that statement, you're meant to infer that he never saw his brother's body.
And then started probably thinking about it in that sense.
Yeah, and so, like, this body is sort of like a realization about what death looks like and the finality of death, and I think he's never processed his brother's death correctly is the wrong word, but hasn't fully figured it out yet because he's a young kid and his parents aren't talking about it and they're not giving him, like, the help he needs to, like, sort of move through that, so he's being left to move through it on his own, and that, like, seeing that body is, like, his final realization of, like, what being dead actually is.
And then
he says it should have been me.
Well, no, but also, like, probably consequently, it
helps him process Chris Chambers' death?
Or, no, but just, like, you could infer that he then, because death is now a real thing that's, like, sitting in these bushes.
Yeah.
He then goes head on to become a writer and, like, take advantage of his life.
Yeah, that's a good inference. Yeah. I think we really, like, cracked it open.
Cracked the case.
I got a couple other scenes lined up, and I'll let you pick from these ones. There's them sort of whispering at the end where it's like, I'm never going to get out of this town, am I, Gordy? And, like, talking about Chris dying. Gordy's comments about the kid dying, be like, he was dead. He wasn't sleeping. He wasn't. Or the milk money scene where River Phoenix cries.
Not the milk money scene.
You don't want to see River Phoenix exposed to that?
No. Number two.
Number two, which was the kid was dead scene. Okay, we'll get that loaded up. Is there anything that, like, really struck you about this movie that you want to talk about?
Well, I'm wondering if I've actually seen the whole movie when I was a kid, and the only scenes I remember. Can we talk about the pie puking contest?
Yeah.
Well, that's not really a contest.
No, let's talk about, why is that in there?
Just to demonstrate
that he is a good storyteller.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of, is it, I guess it's like a relatable.
You couldn't watch it.
Yeah, I was actually, for the first time, and I don't know why, I was feeling nauseous when he's like slamming the castor oil and the raw eggs. It like made my stomach turn. I don't even know what castor oil really is.
It's you put it in your car.
No, it's not. I'm dumb, but I'm not that dumb. Yeah, what did you want to say about that scene?
Well, that scene, and like, I just remember that.
Yeah.
And it's very striking when I was a kid. And I loved when everybody just started puking on everybody. And that fat kid reminds me of Buzz from Home Alone.
That scene, the leech scene, the bridge scene.
The leech scene freaked me out when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand.
Do you think, okay, leeches are usually never that big. And I've been around leeches a lot in my life. I've never had a leech. But that movie, I think, informs every childhood fear of leeches.
Yeah, totally does.
Forever. Like, leeches are the nemesis. It's like leeches, kidnappers, and ghosts. I don't know what kids are afraid of. But leeches are way up
because
there.
Because of that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, always, forever.
other memorable
leech
scenes.
On your testicles is the scariest thing ever.
The part two, like the way like he looks down and he's crying, he's just like, oh no, and like
he died.
Yeah, and he reaches down there and his hand comes up all bloody and it slithers off his hand. Like,
yeah, I thought he died.
Ugh. Did you think he died?
I thought he died.
like as a kid, you thought he died. Like you thought that was something
when
that
I saw
kill
it,
you?
I thought like, oh, he's dead.
What other parts are striking or very memorable that, like...
I think the same thing can be said, what you just said about, like, how the leeches scene informs your fear of leeches throughout your childhood.
Train bridges?
The train bridge.
Yeah, I think I'm afraid of walking over train bridges from then forward. I read a thing about how they shot it, and how they, like, basically they use, like, a 60mm camera or something that has, like, a very limited depth of field, so that the train looks much closer than it was, but it was actually, like, in reality, like, much further away, like, probably 60 meters or 70 meters away kind of thing. But that they were, like, shooting it, and that, like, the Vern and Will Wheaton, like, Gordy LaChance, weren't being afraid enough when they were shooting it. Like, they sort of, like, were just running, like, oh, it's scary. And then, like, Rob Reiner was, like, being, like, trying to, like, get them motivated and get them more motivated, and basically just, like, made them do it over and over and over again, and started telling them that, like, you know, the train's not very far away, so you're not scared of that, but, like, if you don't start doing this better, like, every single crew member here is angry about how warm it is and angry about this, and you have to be afraid of them because they are going to come down on you unless you do this scene right and do it right now. Yeah, and that's how I drilled the fear into them to get it right.
Well, wow.
Piece of trivia.
Yeah, they're just children.
So I'm going to start this scene a little bit, but I'm only going to fade it in when we get to the kid was dead part, because they're sort of like, they're just walking along the tracks and being like, is that the old Harlow Road? Da-da-da-da-da. And you can just talk about it. You know, tell me what you see. Whose outfit do you think is best? Chris Chambers?
I get to watch it.
White shirt.
Teddy?
Yeah?
Yeah, white shirt's always
back
cool.
Back Harlow Road?
Yeah. Our kid must be around here someplace. Teddy, you and Vern watch the left side of the tracks. We'll take the right.
All right.
Beautifully shot film.
Yeah, it looks amazing the whole time. I want to move to Oregon real bad after this movie. I'll tell you another piece, too. So they're walking along the tracks.
There he is! I see him!
Vern finds the body.
Look, over there! I see him! I see him!
None of us could breathe. Somewhere under those bushes was the rest of Ray Brower. The train had knocked Ray Brower out of his keds, just like it had knocked the life out of his body.
Jesus.
The kid wasn't sick. The kid wasn't sleeping. The kid was dead.
And then Gordy sits down and cries and says, it should have been me, it should have been me, and he's sort of processing Denny's death. What do you think about John Cusack as Denny?
It's extremely likable.
Yeah, always so likable.
Well, pre-2000.
Yeah, pre-2000.
You agree with pre-2000?
Yeah, I don't think he's done much post-2000 that's incredibly likable. Except for my one exception that we always talk about.
Tub Tub Babadine?
Hot Tub Time Machine? Is that you saying Hot Tub Time Machine? Bop Bop Babadine? So we're about to wrap up our discussion of Stand By Me. We're nearing the end. What pieces would you like to talk about before we move on?
I want to hear how you feel about two people.
Okay.
And their careers.
All right.
River Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. I don't know anything else he's in, so let's just start there. Like, I know that he's in My Own Private Idaho. I don't think I've seen another River Phoenix movie, unless you name one that maybe I've seen.
There's obviously something about him, though, that is...
incredibly compelling?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome in this.
Like, and, like, just, like, good friends with all kinds of musicians that I love.
He's a... like, he's... has a sort of...
and was a musician himself.
Undeniable cool that, like, is hard to articulate or sort of... and it, like, comes across in this movie.
And
like,
his name is River Phoenix.
Yeah. He's pretty... He's great. He's great in this movie. You like him in My Own Private Idaho. What else was he in?
He was in, like, forgettable movies, I think, for the most part. Besides that, I mean, he was in... what's that? There was a Gus Van Sant remake of... even Cowgirls Get the Blues, you know, that Tom Robbins books? Tim Robbins?
Tom Robbins. So he was in that?
I think briefly in that.
Okay, so not much.
Oh, wasn't he in some sort of...
here's a question
movie
I have.
Movie that actually is about rivers?
I don't know. A river runs through it?
Something like that.
How is it possible that River Phoenix is like has like a sort of charming, unflappable, cool, and that Joaquin Phoenix has like a sort of inherent evil about every role he's ever done?
That's not true.
I think he's her? Like, maybe not her, but other than that, he seems like the most evil person. He's always playing like really bad people.
No, that's not true. Her, Signs?
The Immigrant, the bad guy in Gladiator, the bad emperor, the master. He's not evil, but he's definitely like twisted up and like really scary. He's a scary guy. Even as Johnny Cash in Walk the Line, he's like scary a lot of the time. Like there's like an intensity and like a sort of like evil or like an unsettledness to everything he does that's like really...
But I just named you two where he's clearly a likable character.
Is he likable in her? He's like weird in her. I guess.
Oh, come on.
Sure, we can talk about that more. He's likable, you're right. And I haven't seen Signs.
What about I'm New Here?
I'm New.
We can't just start going off. We got to save our Joaquin talk for now.
What was the other guy you wanted my opinion
Rob about? Reiner.
I don't know. Rob Reiner's an actor and a director. Is that right?
Yeah.
What else has he been in or directed?
Well, he's directed Spinal Tap.
Okay, Spinal Tap's great.
Yeah. He's directed Princess Bride.
Okay, so Rob Reiner kind of is like a home run hitter.
Well, sort of, but he's also directed like really bad movies.
Like bad romantic comedies? Did he do City Slickers? Because I like City Slickers.
No, he did When Harry Met Sally, though.
Okay.
He did like...
He was
Throw Mama from a Train, you ever see that?
Yeah.
A Few Good Men. He's also an actor, too. He's in lots of stuff. Like, he was really great in The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah. Who is he? Oh, he's the dad, right?
DiCaprio's dad, yeah.
I like Rob Reiner. I think he's good. Then,
but he's always like in sort of... He directs like big movies. I don't like just like the big movie directors.
I like the guys...
He's like kind of like a Ron Howard type.
Yeah, but I think there's more heart to these movies than Ron Howard movies.
I think it's kind of the same.
Well, I like those guys. I'm a sucker for guys that can like straddle the line between like reasonable and like popular. Like, you know, think about Rob Reiner and like the movies he's made, and then think about, I know this is going to be out of left field, but like Michael Bay or something like that. Like, I know those are very different, but like that guy will sell out all the integrity he has to be the biggest director on earth, whereas like Rob Reiner just makes like commercially successful films that are also pretty good.
Yeah, I don't like those.
I see. I have a really soft spot for things.
I'd rather you just be the worst.
We're on different pages. I like the like.
He's like the Tom Hanks of directors.
Yeah, I'm into that. I don't like Tom Hanks very much, but I'm into that sort of style. Like, I think that's a really tough thing to be. Do you know what I mean? I think that takes like integrity and like talent to like find what's popular and also
or like Spielberg is another one.
Yeah, Spielberg's worse, but. I can appreciate what Spielberg is a lot worse, but what those guys do in terms of like trying to like marry the worlds of like commercial viability and like a good movie.
But
because without those,
this is always merely well done.
Hear me out.
And like, who cares about well done?
Without those guys, though, like the movies that you love maybe don't get bankrolled because every time someone makes like...
Oh, let's not go. Who cares?
I'm just saying, but without those guys, like if you can't make something like Stand By Me wasn't going to get released. Like
Stand By Me is a fine movie. I enjoyed it.
Jerry O'Connor. Like if that movie
and
didn't
Spinal
exist,
Tap is great, obviously. Yeah. But that's more of like a Christopher Guest thing.
Sure, but I'm just... Like without like Rob Reiner knocking it out of the park on Stand By Me, like chances on movies like Stand By Me don't get taken as much because like basically you come in with like a low budget movie, but you got to hit on 1 in 10 of them. And if you never hit, then people are going to stop funding them.
Yeah.
So I like that some guys like that hit because if without those guys hitting, then like, you know, the chances get lessened. And all we get is Marvel movies. So, and I love like 80s, like sentimental, like I love that this movie tries to be everything to all people. That's one of my favorite qualities of 80s movies.
I hate the everything to all people movies.
I love it. Like The Karate Kid. I love that stuff. I know that it's not necessarily good, but I really like it when it's just like, we're going to be funny, heartfelt, serious.
No,
like
I want
action.
I want like either just like good, interesting ideas or I want specific niche movies. Like the everything to all people movies is just Melba toast.
I don't know what that word means. But, I understand that those movies aren't for everyone.
It might not be a phrase.
But I really like when people try to do it. Because it takes ambition, and it's hard to do. And when it's done right, it feels perfect.
It's just someone doing their job really well, though. It's not art.
I disagree. It's a marriage of art.
It's recycled storytelling that's just done well and hitting all the bases.
I don't know how much longer I can do this show with you if you're this cynical.
Well, we keep doing these kind of movies.
Because your movies aren't fun to talk about. This movie everyone's seen.
Here comes.
And it's fun to talk about. There's so much to talk about with this movie. The cultural impact is giant. Everyone has seen this movie. Everyone, this movie resonates. There's songs named after this movie. There's bands named after. There's a band called Two for Flinching. There's a song called That Summer at Home I'd Become the Invisible Boy. Like, this movie just resonates and has like hit so many people.
Yeah, I like this movie.
So shut up.
All right.
All right, we're going to listen to My Name is Jonas. We're going to move on to the Weezer section. Any introductions you want to give?
Weezer, still going strong?
I guess stronger than ever in a certain respect.
No, not true.
You disagree, stronger than ever?
Stronger than ever.
No, stronger than ever is wrong. You're right.
All right.
Okay, not stronger than ever. I was distracted. We can't get into Weezer yet because Jeff and I have to talk still.
Yeah, we should, yeah.
Finish it up.
We've been fighting about Stand By Me the whole time.
There's no solving this fight because you just like fundamentally different things.
Right. And certainly, I mean, we're talking in absolutes, but that's not probably the case either. But anyways, I just, like, I appreciate this movie and I like this movie. I feel like we've talked about a few movies like this that are just sort of good. They're just good, and like their stories are well done.
I think Stand By Me is closer to great than good, but keep going.
But like, I'm not interested in talking about these kind of stories because they've just been done so many times in one way or another. Like, these sentiments have been expressed and they're just well told stories, and they're pretty safe.
Yeah, it's safe.
And like, there's just nothing like outside of the box that's like a talking point for me.
So you only like movies you can talk about?
No, I like this movie. I keep telling you. I like this movie, but I just don't know what to say about a movie like Stand By Me because it's a good movie.
I think for me, like, those movies have the most to say, like, because it resonates with so many people. Like, why was it so important? Why did this hit, like, to so many people? What did so many people like about this? Like, why does it resonate? Like,
I mean, yeah.
Having, like, sort of that, like, this is critically acclaimed. Like, it's, like, one of the best movies of all time in terms of, like, how well it's reviewed, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. And, like, it's, like you say, it's not crazy important, but what about that is hitting to so many different people? And I find that really interesting.
But I also don't think, like, you have to dig deep to come up with that answer. You know what I mean?
But I like to think about the different things that would resonate with different people. Like, I don't think the answer is the same for everyone. Like, I don't think it's just like four kids on an adventure. That's what I like. I think it's like, you know, I really liked River Phoenix, or I think like I like the 50s part of it. I think that part like made people feel nostalgic. The music is really good and like well chosen and like.
I know, but like, we've said those things before about movies. You know what I mean? Like we've said that.
What's the difference between this and Dazed and Confused? And why do you like Dazed and Confused so much more?
Because Dazed and Confused is a weird cult movie because it was branded as a teen movie, but really it's a like a period piece and a coming of age story and a day in
this is a period piece and a coming of age story and a day in the life.
But it's not. Yeah, I guess it's true, but it's just. Like, Dazed and Confused is obviously different. Like, you know it is.
I know it's different, but I'm just trying to say that, like, you could argue that they're very similar movies.
But it's, like, Dazed and Confused is very meditative, and it's very, like, observational, and it's not trying to push a narrative, and it's not trying to touch on emotions on an obvious, like, slug you over the head kind of way. You know what I mean? It's trying to be like this a slice like of life that's realistic and not more melodramatic.
I don't think that this is melodramatic or not realistic, though.
It's kind of melodramatic.
It's a little bit melodramatic. Like, obviously, the kid's brothers died, etc. But there's nothing about this that feels unbelievable to me or that, like, couldn't have happened or is, like,
but it's heightened pushing in a way that, like, a well-done Hollywood movie is normally heightened.
Sure.
And, I mean, a movie like Dazed and Confused, which we've done recently, I guess that's why you chose that as an example. But that's... I just feel like
they are subtly different, but I guess the point that I'm
I think making, they're much more than subtly different.
The other thing too about this movie is that, and a piece that you're forgetting, is that this movie could have had the same fate as like Dazed and Confused. It was like a low budget movie, like an indie movie that like didn't necessarily like have its sights on being like a box office smash. Like, it wasn't intended to be that. It just became that because people liked it so much and it resonated so much with people. So it could have easily never even got released. You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of...
Yeah, but... yeah, I guess.
I'm just saying, like...
I just feel like when you tell this story and it's well done, I don't think there are a lot of stories that are well done that, like, hit on the sort of emotions a movie like Stand By Me touches on that don't ultimately become very popular, at least down the road.
Sure, but...
Because Stand By Me is probably... has been watched probably far more than Dazed and Confused has been watched.
Totally. But I guess what I'm saying... is that, like, both these movies had similar trajectories at first. Like, they were low-budget, unknown actors. Like, I mean, I guess Kiefer was kind of known, but, like, not really. Like, you understand what I'm trying to argue here, is that, like, at the inception of both these movies, the goal for them was similar. Stand By Me just hit with a crazy bigger amount of people and saw a much broader release as such, and was very critically acclaimed and did very well.
But the other thing is that this is almost... not a good example of the point I'm trying to make, because Stand By Me I still feel like falls into this category, but it's sort of like a little bit on the outskirts of this box that I'm putting it in.
Sure. It pushes and is better than like the kind of movies
than a Clueless, for example.
Yeah.
Or Good Will Hunting or
like. Sure. I think I would never like try to say Good Will Hunting. Like, I understand why Good Will Hunting is not that good. Yeah. And I think that Stand By Me is clearly...
Which are movies we've done if people are just listening.
Which is clearly a better movie. Like, it's melodramatic, but it pushes better and resonates more. The characters are deeper, more well-developed. Like, I understand where they're coming from, more believable, etc. And for all those reasons, I think
it's braver. Like, they don't mind touching upon topics like domestic abuse and stuff like that.
And so, like, I guess the point that I was trying to argue earlier is that, like, for... operating and finding the audience that something like Good Will Hunting finds and something like, you know, whatever else finds, I feel so proud of like Rob Reiner for like doing such a good job and making a movie that like does as well as those movies but is clearly better,
right?
Do you know what I mean? And that's the point, like by like being like commercially successful and like managing to draw those people into like something that like is clearly a much better movie than like Good Will Hunting or any sort of like sentimental like Steven Spielberg like pablum. I don't know if that's the right word.
I think I just always need something weird about a movie for me to like it.
Sure, and that's fair, and that's like important to recognize in yourself. I like movies that are straight but like are great.
Yeah,
it's my thing. Straight and great.
I've just seen them. You've seen one, you've seen them all,
but you haven't seen one as well executed. It's like a, I don't know, it's like a tightly choreographed dance. I don't know what I'm talking about. Let's move on. Let's talk about Weezer.
All right.
We found the fundamental disagreement. Yeah. We're doing The Shining next week. That's as weird as you want it.
Yeah.
So you can just be like, oh, it's so weird. I got so, you better have everything to say next week about it because you
probably will.
You have nothing to say about this
movie. I watched
movie.
Numerous documentaries about The Shining. I've watched numerous documentaries about Kubrick.
Let's talk about Weezer.
Okay. Well, how are we doing for time? How long?
We got like not that much.
All right.
Blue album. Weezer has a new album called, what's it called? Can you remember my great something adventure?
It's called Crap, Crap, Crap. It's Crap, Crap, Crap.
Have you listened to it? Everything will be all right in the end.
Do I need to listen to it?
It's, I mean, I can't tell if I'm sort of repeating the narrative that's going around in all the reviews that have come out. It's better than a lot of the recent stuff has been. It's still not great. It's got some, like that Back to the Shack song is atrocious.
Yeah, it's gross.
You know what I mean? But there have been moments on it when I'm just like, I've forgotten that Weezer has, I forgot about the narrative behind Weezer and how bad they really got. You know what I mean?
But that's like a weird way of listening to a band because.
Totally.
You're listening to it in a context that's outside of the.
You want to know how good it is?
What?
Slightly worse than Come Down Machine is to Is This It and Room on Fire.
Room on Fire is a great record.
Yeah, Room on Fire. So I'm saying the Blue Album, Pinkerton, are Is This It, Room on Fire.
Right.
And that, like, Come Down Machine is their most recent record. And,
oh, right.
And people were like, this is actually kind of okay.
Yeah, okay.
And that's sort of like the way this record's a little bit worse than that. There's still, like, some kind of, like, eye-rolly, nauseating parts. But, like, there are parts where you're just like, you remember in a new context why you liked Weezer so much in the first place.
So I don't have to listen to it.
No. But it could be enjoyable to listen to. You might have a good time. You might be like, oh, yeah, this actually is okay. Like, I don't hate this.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I just consume so much music that just listening to something just to see if it's okay, I just don't have time for that.
Here's my argument against that, which is I get really frustrated with that kind of sentiment, is that you don't have to listen to the whole thing ever again, but listen to it because there's probably two really good songs on it that you'll really like. And then you can put those into your canon of like music to listen to going forward and be like, that song was really good. Like, for instance, an example I use often is the Hold Steady, who have like three great records and then started kind of declining and declining. But there's a song on their most recent record called The Weekenders that's probably top five Hold Steady songs. It's awesome.
Right.
And if I had never listened to that record, I would never have heard The Weekenders.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know what I mean? So I think it's worth listening to like sort of middling reviewed records by bands that you've previously liked, if only to find the couple good songs and to keep those in your canon going forward.
Yep, that's a good point.
So all that being said, let's talk about the Blue Album.
What a record.
What's your favorite song?
Saying It So.
Interesting answer. I think most people choose, I think Only in Dreams is the clear like winner for like critics and.
Really?
Yeah, everybody you talk to, what's your favorite song on the Blue Album? Only in Dreams, Only in Dreams. That's the
I've
winner.
I've never heard that.
Really? No, that's the cool answer. That's like saying what's your favorite Star Wars movie?
Because the singles are Buddy Holly, Undone, and Saying It So, right?
Yeah. Saying It So is the coolest of the singles,
and
for
then,
sure.
And then big songs outside of that, I always thought was My Name is Jonas. What is it? Like Gone Surfing?
Surf Wax America.
Surf Wax America. And then like maybe In the Garage.
Yeah. I mean, I think every song, because it's only 10 songs
only
long.
Only Dreams is kind of plotting.
Yeah. I mean, it's the coolest song on the record. So when you start listening to it in retrospect as you get older, like it's like this 8-minute sprawling, like really like different song. And I think it sort of sticks out as the coolest one. And that like, as you grow up and your critic's taste takes hold a little bit more. Like, it's like, you know, what's your favorite Star Wars movie? You got to answer Empire. What's the coolest song on the Blue Album? You have to answer Only in Dreams. That's not my answer, though. Oh, My Name is Jonas, hands down.
You know what my favorite Star Wars movie is?
Which one?
Barf.
You're going to have to watch one soon when we do the show with Rich.
I know.
Which we've been trying to establish for a while but haven't managed to make happen. What do you want to say about the Blue Album? Anything?
It's a weird, I mean, there are so many bands that have a singular sound that is awesome.
Yeah.
That works for two records.
And
like Strokes is a recent example that we just talked about. Except, I think Pinkerton's
Interpol.
Better. Pinkerton's better.
I disagree, but keep going.
Oh, I think Pinkerton's better, and I think that's a talking point, because I think usually it's the debut record that's amazing. And then the second record that's still
sounds
really
like a
great,
watered down version of the first, but so,
still really great. And then just increasingly,
I think two pieces don't hold up about your analogy.
Okay.
Usually in the instances you're talking about, both records are relatively like well received commercially and critically, and that people all like, it's basically established that the second record sounds like a watered down version of the first, but it's still really great and they still have that great sound. You know what I mean?
Pinkerton was, yeah.
Pinkerton sonically is very different than the Blue Album.
No.
I swear to God, try to listen to it even production wise. Like, it's way less slick. It sounds garagier. The drums are like raw and way more up front.
Hmm.
It's like definitely like a rougher, it's like way rougher around the edges in terms of production. It sounds awesome. It's sort of like, a good example would be like In Utero to Nevermind, but a little bit more extreme. That it's like they went for a raw, rougher sound, and it like it comes out. And that this record was like critically lambasted and commercially unsuccessful, and like fans hated it. They wrote to like Rivers Cuomo telling him how much they hated it. Like, he like took a lot of grief over Pinkerton.
Yeah, he went into a big funk.
Yeah. I mean, everybody knows the sort of story of Weezer, like in the Pinkerton hate.
Well, in between Pinkerton and Blue Album, he went to Harvard.
Yeah.
As a rock star.
He put up that cool ID picture.
Yeah.
And then they come back with the Green Album, which is his sort of like FU to everybody, being like, you guys want pop songs? I'll give you the slickest pop song record you ever heard.
It was a big stinker, but people just like granted them grace because they were just happy to have like a healthy looking Weezer back in their lives.
Well, it wasn't critically very well received. It just like commercially did okay. And like sort of, it was a weird record too, because I didn't love the singles. Like, I don't ever need Hash Pipe or Island in the Sun or any of those songs, but I like some of the songs on it. And we've talked about this, but the biggest problem with that record is the way it exists as a record, because every song is an identical formula. And once you unpack that formula, the whole record becomes super robotic, because you realize that every song is going to move in the exact same way. There's no surprises. And that's sort of really discouraging from like a listener standpoint.
Right.
And then did you ever listen to anything? Maladroit, Make
Just
Believe.
Just the singles.
What do we got? Maladroit, Make, if you can name them all, I'll give you $5.
Hurley?
No, In Order.
In Order, okay. So after the Green Album?
Yeah.
Maladroit, Red Album?
No, you already lose.
Maladroit, Make Believe, Red Album, Hurley. What's the one with the dog? Ratitude?
Yeah, there's Ratitude in there.
What did I miss?
Let's see if you missed any.
And then the new one.
You missed Death to False Metal.
Oh, yeah.
And Ratitude is pre-Hurley, not post. And, yeah. So basically, you blew
it. Give me $1.
Give you $1. The Blue Album. Do you want to go back to the Blue Album?
I
want to
ask you a question.
Okay, what?
Rivers Cuomo.
Cool or not cool?
He's not dumb.
No, he's super smart.
Right?
Went to Harvard.
Well, why is he dumb?
I think he's a really
good question.
I think he's a really spiteful person.
I went to
person.
Journalism school. Rivers Cuomo is not dumb, right? So why is he dumb?
He's insecure and spiteful. I think those are the two things.
You know what, though? I listened to him on Mark Maron's WTF.
Yeah.
And he sounds like, that's a long, intimate interview format.
Yeah, I know.
And he sounds really well-adjusted and grounded and, like, healthy.
I think he's finally there. But I think the material speaks for itself between, like, the Green Album and the new record, where he was just, like, didn't care, was angry, like, was going to make the worst, like, was deliberately sort of making, like, garbage pop that was, like, consumable and disposable.
Beverly Hills.
Yeah, Beverly Hills is by far the worst song.
Yeah.
Except for maybe, like, Pork and Beans or something, which is even stupider.
Yeah.
The Red Album is stupid.
We Are All on Drugs is pretty stupid.
But I think that that's sort of, I think that it was an insecurity, like a sort of, if he tried hard or tried to make like a sentimental, I think he's been afraid of rejection ever since Pinkerton, whether he admits it or not. I also think, and this is sort of like revisionism coming out, but Maladroit is not as bad as people remember, but it was also, it was like a Pinkerton all over on a smaller scale. That like the Green Album had sort of reestablished them. People like paid attention and cared, and then they went and did Maladroit, and it was rejected all over again.
But wasn't that the video with like the Muppets in the video and stuff?
Yeah, but it didn't mean like
they kept like trying to do cute videos.
I don't remember when that video was,
but they do a video with baby animals, and they do a video with Muppets, and then they do a video with the Playboy Mansion. Like they're just like these grand populist gestures, like, look at us, we're Weezer, you like us because we have cute animals in our video.
Sure. I'm trying to answer your question that you asked in the first place, which was why does he do what he does, and why is there that string of terribleness?
Yeah.
And I think it's the rejection factor. And like basically right after Maladroit, he then goes and makes Make Believe, which is by far their biggest like F you, we like absolutely don't care.
Right.
I'd like to revisit Maladroit. I think that would be an interesting re-listen, and probably one of like the third, it might be the third best Weezer album. In retrospect.
Have you listened to Hurley? Apparently Hurley's got some good songs on it.
I have not listened to Hurley.
But this is the thing. Like they have all these records now, and none of them are worth listening to, except for maybe that reason that you gave at the beginning when we started talking about this, like there might be a couple gems.
Yeah, if someone made me, like if some really big Weezer fan went through and made me a mixtape of the like best two songs from all of their past records, I would be curious about listening to that.
But that's like...
But I'm not going to do that work myself.
The amount of bands that you love, one or two or how many records of them, but then also put out like crappy records that you feel obliged to check out because you liked them in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of time that you spend sifting through bad music to find the two gems, like that's the amount of time that you're not listening to like Fela Kuti, for example.
I understand.
Like discovering something.
I understand the worthwhile opportunity cost argument that you're making.
Right.
But I think there's something to be said for like loyalty to something that you once thought was great, and to like continue to like at least until a band betrays you enough times. And Weezer's track record is too far gone; like they don't deserve your, like they don't deserve you trying anymore. Like they blew it.
I actually probably pretty much do the one, maybe two subsequent albums.
Yeah, and I think that's all you can do. Like past that, you don't owe it to a band if they blew it twice.
Yeah.
You know, and then you maybe give the third one, or the third one's getting really bad reviews, and you're just like, it's going to be more of the same effort. That's fine. But like the first time they get middling reviews, and you just back out, and you're like, I'm done.
I backed out after, like, Hold Steady was an example that you gave.
Yeah.
I listened to, what was the album?
Stay Positive.
Stay Positive. I liked their first two singles. I listened to the record and, like, got weird vibes from a lot of the songs in that record. And then saw reviews for their next record, Heaven Is Whenever, and just didn't like the single, and saw the reviews that said it's more of the same.
Yeah.
And I just didn't
Yeah. And that's sort of fair. I think like I'm willing to go one more, I think, usually with a band I'm loyal to. But yeah, it's fair.
But Weezer's different though, because I love their first two records. Love the videos. We should talk about the videos.
Yeah.
Because those Blue Album videos are awesome.
Super iconic. And it's mostly just, well, so obviously the big one is
Buddy Holly.
And that was the Happy Day Spike Jonze one. The other one is a Spike Jonze one as well, where they just...
Undone.
What happens in that? They just play in like...
They're in like a green screen, although I think it's a blue screen or whatever.
Yeah.
And but just the way that the camera moves around and the way that they're like kind of playing their instruments and stuff. And
can we talk about...
Or like animals start running around the set and stuff.
A weird thing, the dialogue in Undone, the sweater song.
Yeah.
What's the deal? I think my biggest beef, and this is sort of happens to me sometimes, beef is the wrong word, but in my mind, I didn't get into this record till much later in my life. Like it came out in 94. I didn't buy it till 99. And that was the first time I heard it all the way through. And I thought this band was a novelty band, the same as like Natta Surf all that kind of thing. Because like the sweater song just seemed like this novelty song, and Buddy Holly seems kind of like a novelty song. And then I think like Say It Ain't So came out in the summer when I was away, and so I didn't ever really hear that song kind of thing. And those were my two pieces of information. I was just like, who is this dumb novelty band?
I think those spoken word parts in that song are a really interesting way
of dissecting Kiyomo's headspace.
I think it's a really interesting way of representing depression in this, like, in the environment of a young 20-something,
okay,
like early 20s, like that, like you're at a party, and like that's how you would respond to like that kind of crap. Like they're not unreasonable conversations.
No,
but you just like when you hear that kind of talk at a party or something, you're just like, okay. You know, I just think that's really interesting, actually. Because it's different than like the guy in Natta Surf singing and Popular, because that's just like dumb.
Yeah. We're getting very close to out of time. So let's talk about whatever. We got to talk about a couple things. We got to talk about what we're going to talk about next week. Any final thoughts on the Blue Album and maybe one last song to ease us out of here. So start with final thoughts on the Blue Album.
A classic record only to be usurped by Pinkerton. And that style of music.
We never finished that either, but we're not gonna finish that on air.
No.
Why do you like Pinkerton better?
I just like the raw emotional. It just sounds less. I like that it's less polished. I like that it's more rawly emotional instead of sort of a put on, even if like the put on the Blue Album's like comes from a real place.
Yeah.
Like it, like Pinkerton sounds like it's coming off the rails.
Yeah.
And I like that.
I like also that the songs sound a bit more unhinged. Like the drum fills and like Tired of Sex are crazy and the guitar solos are a lot wackier. I think that's
El Scorcho is my favorite Weezer song too.
The guitar solos even between those two records, like on Pinkerton, they're amazing, and they're just these thrashy, like crazy things that are really unhinged. And then you like go to the Green Album, and the guitar solos are just replications of the melodies in the A sections of the song. So it's just like the verse melody as a solo, and then the B section.
But the lines like, "I asked you to go to the Green Day concert. You said you never heard of them. How cool is that? So I went to your room and read your diary."
Yeah,
like that's
it's insane.
It's insane.
It's really stalkery
and great.
Well, you know what my favorite song is? Favorite Weezer song, and it is from Pinkerton, hands down, Across the Sea.
Yeah,
that song is ballin'.
That's a good song.
So let's talk about what we're gonna talk about next week. We're gonna do The Shining and Danny Brown's Triple X.
I said let's do a Kubrick movie, and you said The Shining,
and then you said, you gave me the parameters of the last 5 years the record had to come out.
Yeah,
which we've not done yet, and I'm still a bit wary about, but we're gonna do Danny Brown's Triple X.
Yeah,
because Danny Brown's coming to town for Pop Explosion. I think it's an appropriate time to do that record.
I'm looking forward to doing Danny Brown.
Yeah, Danny Brown's, I'm looking forward to doing Danny Brown.
Well, you
Brown.
Think about like 20 years from now, Danny Brown would be a really interesting pick.
Yeah.
You have 20 years to digest the cultural.
I think I'm always a bit wary about hip-hop stuff because I don't feel like I know enough about hip-hop history to comment on like where Danny Brown sits. But hopefully you can.
I can do that.
You can do that. And finally, we should play a song to get us out of here. What would you like to hear?
I'll pick four, you pick three, I pick two, you pick one.
Okay, go fast.
Saying Ain't So, Undone, Surf Wax America, and Garage.
Garage, Say It Ain't So. Oh, I have to pick three. And
let's
Buddy
just
Holly.
Play Saying Ain't So.
Okay.
But that's normally my choosing game.
That's the one... So long and complicated. All right, this is Say It Ain't So. You've been listening to 10 Things I Hate About YouTube. We'll be back next week to talk about The Shining and Danny Brown's Triple X.
We should watch Room 234.
Okay, we'll see if we have time. We've been bad about watching our movies.
We should. I